Michael Dawson joins me to talk about malt in his new book, Mashmaker. This is Beersmith Podcast number 165.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 165, and it's early February 2018. Michael Dawson joins me this week to talk about malt and his new book, Mashmaker. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They have a great online learning platform at learn.beerandbrewing.com, where you can take a wide variety of online courses in brewing. They have an offer code, BEERSMITH2018, which gives you 20% off when you sign up for any of their online courses. Learn about brewing at learn.beerandbrewing.com. And also the new BrewVision thermometer from Blickman Engineering. This interactive wireless digital thermometer connects right to your iPhone or iPad and lets you remotely monitor and record temperatures. You can download your recipes right from the Beersmith Cloud and set updates and alerts as you brew. Get the BrewVision Bluetooth thermometer today, another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, Beersmith software, the industry standard for home and professional brewers that lets you design great beer recipes and brew with confidence. Download your free 21-day trial from beersmith.com today. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome Michael Dawson. Michael was the founding member of the Brewing TV team and is an editor of Brew Your Own Magazine. He's a BJCP certified beer judge and writes for Growler Magazine. He just published a new book called Mashmaker, which I have in my hot little hands here, A Citizen's Brewer Guide to Making Great Beer at Home. Michael, it's great to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me, Brad. It's great to be back.
How are things up there in the, you're in the St. Paul, Minnesota area, right?
Absolutely. This morning, it's all of 1 degree out here, so I'm layered up. But yeah, things are good. Things are good.
So what have you been up to since I saw you, I think, last time at HomebrewCon, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like you mentioned, writing a book that came out in November, so just about 3 months ago or so.
Yeah, this one here, right?
That one, that one there. Yep. So apart from that, you know, spending time with my family, wife and daughter, and trying to ride my bike as much as I can. Despite the weather.
Lovely, lovely. Well, you do have a book out called Mashmaker, and I'm going to hold it up one more time here. There we go. Can you tell us a little about the book?
Yeah, so like you mentioned, I wrote for The Growler, which is a local kind of beer and craft beverage and food publication here in the Twin Cities, and I wrote a homebrew column for them for several years. And out of those years worth of columns, we kind of compiled this narrative heavy book of beer recipes. You know, I don't know if you've had a chance to flip through it, Brad, but it's got a lot of kind of story and narrative attached to each recipe.
I was looking it over. There's obviously, at the beginning you have kind of an intro to brewing, but it's fairly short. And then, and then you kind of jump right into the recipes.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's all grain. Although, I think there is a cider recipe in there, which would kind of be the outlier. But otherwise it's all, kind of a mixture of classic styles and, more loosely defined stuff, I guess. There's a sati, some kettle sours, some kind of non-traditional stuff as well.
And as you mentioned, each of the recipes has a little story attached to it.
Yeah. Yeah. No beer exists in a vacuum, right? So, I love to give kind of context and an account of my personal journey with each beer as much as possible, and the feedback on that has been good. So, yeah, it's out there in the world now.
Well, awesome. Well, we'll talk some more about that at the end, but today you wanted to talk a little bit about malts. So I thought maybe we'd start with some of the basic malt types. There's
sure.
Let's see, base malt. Well, I'll let you go through them.
Yeah. So how these categories would be labeled exactly depends somewhat on the maltster or the manufacturer. But like you mentioned, you know, base malt, caramel malts, kilned malts, and roasted malts would be some pretty generally applicable categories that we could put everything into. Base malts, you know, this is going to be remedial for a lot of your listeners, of course, but base malts would include things like pale malt, Pilsner malts, Vienna, Munich, mild ale malt, things like that. The stuff that provides the enzymes and fermentables as well as nutrients for the yeast during fermentation. Those can be made from usually what we see these days is 2-row barley in the craft beer world, but a lot of those can be made from 6-row barley varieties as well. Caramel malts are, you know, for color, flavor, shelf stability, foam stability, things like that. And they're produced with an extra step in the process beyond what a base malt would use. Mm-hmm. Kiln malts, things like biscuit, amber, brown malt, all the way up to chocolate and black malt, roasted barley are used for color and flavor as well. And those can, rather than sweetness or fermentable sugars, give some biscuity to chocolatey to kind of acrid, roasty coffee notes. And that's malt. If you can, I mentioned barley, but of course, like any cereal grain can be used to make malt. So you'll also find rye and oats and wheat as the base grain for malts as well.
Sure. Can you walk us through the malting process, the basic malting process, and how some of the different malts are made? Because each of the different categories kind of has a slightly different approach to the way they're handled, right?
Sure. Yeah. So the basic process for any malt is going to be steeping, germination, and kilning. The steeping is soaking in water to bring the moisture level of the harvested grain kernel up to a certain level that's necessary for germination. That's going to take roughly 24 to 36 hours. Then the next 4 days, basically, after the grain is steeped and absorbs a bunch of water, it will be allowed to germinate. And that's what activates the enzymes. It starts to break down the really high molecular weight proteins and starches in the kernel that'll eventually make it more available for yeast when we actually get around to working with it in the brewery. Once the germination has reached a sufficient level for the malt that's to be made, that would be the degree of modification that maltsters and brewers refer to. The germination is stopped and the grain is dried out in a kiln. And that'll take another 24 to 48 hours, depending on the moisture level after germination, things like ambient temperature. It's a lot easier in Minnesota, at least, to dry malt in the winter, just because the humidity is so low. You can drive off moisture a lot faster when it's cold out and the air is dry than in the summer when it's warm and humid. So all in all, the process for producing a malt is going to take 7 or 8 days, give or take, mm-hmm. of pretty constant attention to all those parameters. So at that point, you've got green malt, and how far it's kilned will kind of determine whether you'd call it a Pilsen, Vienna, Munich, pale ale. At least in part, that would be a determining factor.
From what I understand, they turn the temperature up, right? Near the end of the process, they turn the temperature up and to make some of the darker kiln malts, right?
Yep. Yep. There are a lot of kind of process decisions that a maltster will make. And the temperature at during kilning is one of them. Like you mentioned, you know, for a Pilsner malt, you'd want a temperature that's very low. I believe 180 Fahrenheit, something like that. Mm-hmm. Again, it's going to be kind of dependent on the malt and the conditions that it's being dried under. For a roasted barley or a chocolate malt or something like that, you'd have the ability to turn the heat much higher than that to get the dark color and flavors and
Right. I mean, they're heated to several hundred degrees, yeah. I think, something yeah. like that, right? To really roast them and yep. almost burn them, right?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, if you look at, kernel of black malt or roasted barley, it's black. It's like a roasted coffee bean. It's the outside is burned.
And then crystal malt's somewhat unique. It's made in a different way, right?
Mm-hmm. So at the end of kilning, to create a caramel malt or a crystal malt, you re-steep the kernels, and it's basically a mash that's conducted inside the kernel. The enzymes which you've activated and fostered during germination and preserved during that low kilning to produce green malt, those get recruited during the second steeping to sacrifice some of the starches. In the endosperm, and the malt is then re-kilned, and those sugars which were created in that steep are caramelized, and you get all these great aromas and flavors out of the kilning of those steeped malts. Anything from very light, like a caramel or a caramel 10, with a lot of like honey and pastry kind of flavors, all the way up to like a special B type malt or a extra dark crystal with much deeper reddish brown colors and raisiny, figgy, burnt sugar kind of aromatics and flavors.
But during that second steeping, there you're kind of bringing it up basically the same temperature we mash at, right? And that's what converts exactly. the sugars, and then like you said, it gets dried out again after that, right?
Yep. Yeah, exactly. It's the mechanics will be familiar to any all grain brewer. It's a mash. It's just conducted without milling the grain. It all is contained within the husk.
Right. You don't have it. It's not sitting in water at that point, although it has been, a lot of water has been added to it, but.
Right. Moisture needs to be brought, it's down to, below 10%. Below 8% probably after the green malt is kilned, and then it needs to be brought back up to around 50% moisture again for that sacrification to take place. Mm-hmm. So that adds days onto the production cycle.
And from what I understand, most of the barley grown in the U.S. now is made from just a few barley varieties, right? There aren't that many anymore that are grown, right?
It kind of depends on where you go. Here in Minnesota and North Dakota, there's a fair amount of barley grown, but it's mostly six row. And most of that is a variety called Tradition. If you go out west, you'll see, in like Montana, Idaho, Washington, you'll start to see more two row varieties. That would be kind of dominated by, Harrington, Metcalf, get up into Canada, and there's a lot of Copeland barley grown. So it kind of depends. There are, I believe, 29 or 30 different barley varieties that are recommended by the AMBA, the American Malting Barley Association. And that's a trade organization of maltsters and brewers, whose purpose is to kind of communicate with barley farmers, what they want to see out.
So, so is that the 20, you said 29 varieties, is that primarily for beer brewing? I assume, yeah, because obviously barley is grown for a lot of other things, right?
Yeah, a lot of barley, you know, is grown for feed and food products, but it's the parameters that maltsters and brewers need are pretty specific. And so those 29 varieties are recognized by AMBA or approved by AMBA as having the most favorable qualities for maltsters and brewers, you know, in terms of like protein level, extract, and other things like resistance to disease and kind of the just like the structural integrity of the plant, basically the straw strength and things like that, that are kind of a factor for harvesting and bringing it to the malt house in optimal condition. So one thing that's kind of interesting, I was looking at this list a few weeks ago, and it's like you point out, there's a lot of Harrington, I think, has been on the list since 1989, so it's a little bit of a war horse, but there's a new variety that was approved by AMBA this year called Propino, which I don't think has been grown much commercially in the U.S., but it's been used in the U.K. and Ireland for quite a while for making two-row pale malt over there. So that could be a pretty interesting thing to have grown domestically.
I understand, though, at one time, a much larger variety of barley was grown, particularly in the U.S. and around the world. Why did so many of these heritage malts disappear over time?
Man, that's a really good question. I think it's kind of the story of 20th century agriculture in general, though. You know, not just barley varieties. I think, you know, I garden a little bit, and I am on the mailing list for this company called Seed Savers, which has heirloom seeds of, you know, just about any vegetable you could imagine. And there was certainly a lot of genetic and geographic diversity from, you know, our grandparents' generation and before in things like corn and tomatoes and dill. I've got some crazy Dutch strain of dill that's just taking over my one corner of my backyard. But a lot of these heirloom plants have just kind of been hybridized for the sake of economics, whether like I mentioned, disease resistance is kind of a factor in what malting barley farmers and any farmers really are looking for in a plant. Disease means reduced yield and kind of a poorer quality crop generally.
Yeah, I know. In some cases, wipe things out. I can think of hop farming in New York, which at one time New York's provided a large percentage of the hops used in the U.S. and it was even exported to England, but was largely wiped out by disease, I believe.
Absolutely, and it was the same story in the 1860s, right next to me in Wisconsin, where you know, it was a huge hop farming industry there around the time of the Civil War, and I think it was I want to say it was a vitriculum
I'm not gonna remember the name. I think that's right, actually.
Yeah, but there was a disease that just eradicated it, and that's certainly the case for a lot of the older barley varieties. They're very susceptible to things like fusarium and ergotic mold, which is kind of a landmine of the malting process. And so as newer varieties were bred to have greater resistance to those types of disease, as well as you know, more favorable processing characteristics like the strength I mentioned,
or of course a lot, the yields have improved dramatically too over what we were growing probably 100 years ago, right?
You know, and that's why a barley variety like Maris Otter has had so much success for the past 50 years, is because it just yielded better than its predecessors. You know, maybe a new hybrid barley variety is easier to work with. It matures faster. you know, I mentioned Copeland being one that's on my mind because we at work here, we just did a trial with identical recipes brewed with Pilsner malts made from 5 different barley varieties. And the Copeland was one that really stood out to me. And that is an early maturing 2-row that does awesome in Alberta and, you know, kind of the Canadian plains where the growing season is shorter than it is here in the States. Mm-hmm. And so if a farmer can plant a barley that's grows faster and matures quicker and yields more, bye-bye heirloom.
Yeah. Well, we're now seeing, though, some of the heritage varieties actually being revived and grown for craft brewing, many of them by craft maltsters. Can you tell us a little bit about that story?
Yeah, I mean, God bless the Luddites, right? And their Dutch dill taking over their backyard. It's cool to see interest in a lot of these varieties being revived, whether it's, you know, a vegetable in your garden or a barley. And there's a lot of work being done to bring some of these back. And it's supported by kind of an interest in history and terroir, I guess, among the
yeah,
the
use a French term, right? Can you explain that term, terroir?
Yeah, you know, my interpretation of it or my explanation of it would just be the expression of the environment and the growing conditions.
Right, it's used in winemaking. Uses that word all the time.
Yeah, it's like an expression of the time and place where a product was grown, organoleptically. So, you know, tasting the soil or the weather, the growing conditions, the season, the sunshine. It's very, very poetic. I kind of think there's still something to it. You know, it's the whole nature versus nurture thing, right? Like part of what will make a hop or a barley or grape or anything like that taste the way it does and behave the way it does in the mash tank or the fermenter or whatever. Is genetic, right? Maris otter is going to yield better than your ancient British landrace barley. It's going to be more resistant to fusarium wilt.
But if I grow Maris otter in Minnesota, it's going to be different than perhaps the one we get from England, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. Because we've got a very moderate maritime climate where Maris otter is grown in the UK, and we've got a dry continental climate in places like the central United States and Canada, and even in continental Europe. So the place where a plant is grown is going to affect how it tastes. Mm-hmm. So having said that, like it's still cool to see a lot of these old genetics come back. A couple that I have direct experience with are some 19th century barley varieties that crisp malting from England has brought back. Mm-hmm. Chevalier has been in the States for a little while. Sierra Nevada, Goose Island, Gigantic in Portland. I'm just trying to rattle off some places that I've brewed with it off the top of my head. But that was kind of, that was the Maris otter of England in the 1800s. It was kind of the king of malting barley. And it was actually, spun out of a land race. It was kind of like the story of Amarillo. It was found just happened to be growing in a field. It was named for the I think he was a pastor, Anglican pastor who owned the land, Reverend Chevalier. And the barley just kind of took the English brewing world by storm. But it was eventually phased out in the early 20th century, like we said, because it had been replaced by newer hybrids that yielded even more and had better resistance to disease and things like that.
But you can get that again now, right?
You can get that again.
It's crisp, you said?
Crisp, yeah. And they've done another one called Plumage Archer, which is a cross between an English land race and a Danish barley. And that's a pretty cool one, too. Chevalier is, it's different. Like, you can tell that it's not a 20th century plant. It's a little earthier. It's a little more rustic tasting. Mm-hmm. It's not unrecognizable as an English pale malt, but it's just a little different. It can take a really high hop load very well. If you read any of the kind of contemporary accounts of the hop rates used in the early IPAs that were exported, it's a lot of hops, and Chevalier kind of has the backbone to stand up to that. It makes a great mild ale as well. Does well with lower gravities because it brings in a lot of character just by itself. It's a cool barley. Plumage Archer is a little more modern to me. I kind of want to describe it as like an English Vienna malt. It's fairly pale, clean tasting, but it's got this really nice, bright, biscuity note. I've done mild ales with that. Done some bitters. Got friends who've made some stouts and even like a smoked porter with it. That's also a pretty cool barley. That's a newer variety that's just kind of hitting the States right now.
And you've had a chance to brew with both of these, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. I speak from personal experience.
Mm-hmm. And, you like them, right? I mean, they've come out nice.
Yeah. There's a recipe in the book, in fact, for like a single malt barley wine, an English style barley wine with all Chevalier in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I've got a beer on tap at home right now. That's a Plumage Archer and Target Smash. It's just kind of loosely based on a Scottish, an 1880, I think, Scottish 80 shilling from Ron Pattinson's books. You could almost mistake it for a Pilsner. It's got that bright, biscuity, sort of reminiscent of Vienna quality to it. It's also a pretty cool malt.
And we're also starting to see malts that actually reflect the terroir of the area they're grown in, right? So how does the growing region affect the flavor? And can you give us a couple examples, maybe, or an example or two?
Sure. The protein level, the starch content, an enzyme package of a malt, all those things are going to kind of be influenced by where it's grown.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess if I can use another specific new malt as kind of an example, Weirmann has, this is not an heirloom variety, but this is like a new hybrid that they've developed with the intent of growing barley where it's not typically grown.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Eric Clea.
Okay.
And, I remember in one of Michael Jackson's books, he talks about the barley belt, which is kind of, the Northern United States, Canada, that latitude, which includes England and Central Europe. Southern Europe is what would kind of traditionally be the grape belt. Wine grapes grew better in Southern Europe than barley did, and so those cultures developed into winemaking cultures. But in the interest of just kind of, I guess, hedging bets against climate change, mm-hmm. and the barley belt possibly moving in the future, Eraclea was developed to grow in a wine region, basically. So it's grown in Northeast Italy on the Adriatic coast, which is more known for white wines, you know, Prosecco and Suave. If I'm remembering my
Prosecco is correct, right. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's an arid coastal climate, and Eraclea can actually acquire and retain moisture from the fog that comes in on the Adriatic in the morning. So it does well in this environment that would historically have been pretty averse to barley and malting barley specifically, but
so they're growing a Pilsner in this relatively dry climate, huh?
Yeah, in this kind of chalky, minerally soil, and it makes this really lovely, delicate Pilsner malt. It's not as hearty, I guess, in terms of flavor, mm-hmm. as you know, something that would be grown north of the Alps in Europe or in the Western US. But it makes a fantastic Kolsch or just kind of a nice simple pale lager. This is the poetry of terroir, but I feel like you can kind of get some of that minerality, some of that chalky soil and maritime fog quality out of it.
Mm-hmm. And you have you brewed with this as well, the Eraclea Pilsner from Weirmann.
I haven't brewed with it at home, but I've used it on the RAR Technical Center brewery here across the street from my office. So I'll count that. It's a nice. Hey, it's Jay Keeler, everybody.
Hey, Jake. He's in the back of the video for those of you watching it, listening on the audio. Yeah. But go ahead. So let's go to, I believe some of the small malt houses are also experimenting with locally grown malts, right? We're starting to see craft malting pop up all through the Midwest and Northeast again, right?
Yeah, and I know there's a few out in the Rockies and in the Pacific Northwest as well. Again, you know, God bless the Luddites and feeding that interest in the local and the terroir and the old school.
And a lot of them are growing and malting their own malts, their own barley, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So what are your thoughts on the craft malting trend? Do you think this is going to continue?
You know, I think that as long as there's a market for it, which there seems to be at the moment, I think we'll continue to see these places kind of doing their thing and filling their niches. We saw a similar phenomenon a few years ago with small hop farms, at least here in the Midwest, and I believe there's others.
They're popping up in the Northeast as well.
Yeah, for sure. And I don't think they're going to put Yakima Chief out of business, but they've got a local market. We've got 6,000 odd breweries in the United States now, which is just a ridiculous number. Mm-hmm. And
I think the most ever, right? Dwarfs the number we had before Prohibition, I believe.
Yeah. So there's plenty of demand for these raw materials, and especially when they have a story attached to them, and that helps the brewer and the consumer kind of forge a connection with it somehow.
Yeah, locally grown beer, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You have locally grown hops, locally grown malt, right?
I can hook you up with some locally grown dill too, Brad.
Dill, okay. Well, that's great. I'll try. I don't know. Does dill go well in the beer? I haven't tried that yet.
I use it in pickles.
Pickles is probably a better use of the dill, yeah. Well, I wanted to spend a few minutes at the end swinging around back to your book called Mashmaker, and I was wondering if... How'd you get involved in writing this thing? How'd you decide to write it?
It was about 5 or 6 years ago. The editorial team at the Growler, which was just kind of a fledgling publication at that point, approached me and asked if I wanted to do a monthly column for their website and then the print magazine. I said yes, and we just kind of started doing a recipe a month. Sometimes it was tied to a theme. For an international issue that they did, I did a Belgian blonde ale with red cargo rice from Southeast Asia. And I think we used German hops in it too to just kind of like bring it full circle. Other times it's just kind of been whatever I felt like. And so we did a lot of German lagers and things like that. Those recipes, after piling up for whatever it was, 5 years, we looked at it and said, we should turn these into a book. And thought, like you mentioned, there's a kind of a gloss on how to and raw materials at the front of the book, just for the sake of completion. We wrote some new recipes. I wrote some new recipes, I should say. The Royal We being a really great editorial team and illustrators at the Growler, we put together some new recipes that had never before been published to include in the book, and went to press the end of last summer, and it was released right around Thanksgiving.
And 80% of the book is recipes, so I wanted to. Of course, the interesting part to me is the backstories, because they each come with about a page and a half of a backstory with them.
Yeah.
Can you share a couple of the stories here, maybe between a couple of your recipes?
Sure. Yeah. So, to celebrate the launch of the book, we worked with a brewery here in St. Paul, Bad Weather Brewing Company, to do one of the recipes. And we did it because the book was released right before Thanksgiving. We did it on Black Friday. It's a black IPA. And the name of the beer is called Neck Tat, that says evil.
Nice. Evil Black Friday, huh?
Yeah, yeah. It was very, very Scandinavian death metal. The story behind this beer is... a while ago, I was traveling for work to go to a brewing conference, and on the way, I'm going to change names to protect the innocent here, but or omit names to protect the innocent, I should say. On the way, I stopped.
We will mention Jake, right?
Who?
Yeah. Go ahead.
On the way, we stopped at a brewery that had just won a medal at GABF for what I believe. In that arena of competition, they call American Black Ale. They don't get into the whole black IPA, Cascadian, dark fracas. It was a gold medal winning beer at GABF. Really, really tasty. Hung out at this brewery for a while and then continued on to where the conference was being held. During one of the seminars, I sat next to a guy who had a neck tattoo, and because I'm just a pasty-faced, you know, shy, introverted Midwesterner, I didn't want to make eye contact with somebody who had a neck tattoo. I mean, he might have been from prison, he might be into drugs, he might kill me. I'm pretty sure that the neck tattoo said evil.
Nice.
I can't confirm that with 100% certainty, but I hate to let truth get in the way of a good story. So I just told myself that neck tattoo says evil. And I sat next to this guy who's probably a mass murderer. I'm sure he's not. I'm sure the neck tattoo didn't say evil either, but I didn't read it and it's made a great story. So
it's probably Dr. Evil, right?
Probably was. Yeah. It's probably his family name. That makes a lot of sense. Or his child, little Evil Johnson. Anyway, I had that beer again at the conference shortly after, sitting next to the guy with the neck tattoo. And, I said, I should try to do a beer like this when I get back home. That recipe got printed, in a future edition of the Growler. And, that was kind of the launch party for the book. We did 10 barrels of it at Bad Weather, and homebrewers who'd signed up and RSVP'd could come in and take 5 gallons of the wort home and ferment it. And nice. So, yeah, I've had a lager version of it that somebody did. I've had a version with extra dry hops. Yeah, yeah. That's all the recipes are presented with tweaks and variations. I don't assume that anything will be done exactly to spec in the book. I encourage aftermarket modifications.
Nice. Well, maybe one more quick story if you got time.
Yeah. Trying to think of another good one here. My wife and I like to play games and trash talk. I was on a really bad losing streak of bocce in our backyard. I'd just been getting spanked by her mercilessly. My ego was taking a bruising from all the trash talking I was receiving. And I decided that I needed an equalizer in the form of a beer. And so I did a cream ale. You know, it wasn't, you know, a particularly strong beer or anything like that, but it was just extremely crushable in the hopes that she would overconsume and this would adversely affect her bocce game.
Her bocce skills, yes.
Yeah. It ended up backfiring on me.
Mm.
But I figured, you know, I mean, that still kind of validated my approach. And so that recipe got turned into a recipe or into a column as well. And then eventually into the book. That's called Bocce Swerve Cream Ale.
I enjoy a good game of bocce. I mean, you know,
if you ever come back to Minnesota when it's not 1 degree out, I'll let you play my wife.
Okay. Well, what are some of your takeaways from finishing your first book?
You know, it took longer than I thought, but I enjoyed it quite a bit. I'm really, really proud of the finished product, and I'm happy to be able to say I've done it. It definitely helps to have a good editor. So I want to thank John Garland and the rest of the team at the Growler for all their work on it. Yeah, it's available at mashmakerbook.com.
Mm-hmm. I've got the website up here for those of you on the video. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mashmakerbook.com. It also comes up if you just Google Mashmaker, actually.
First. Oh, that's
the
that's
very good. First. Yeah. Very first entry, I think.
SEO. So,
yeah, exactly. Well, Michael, I wanted to thank you again for agreeing to come on the show. It's been great having you here.
Thanks for having me, Brad. It's nice to be back.
And again, today my guest was Michael Dawson. Michael's a BJCP beer judge, avid brewer, and author of the new book, which I'll hold up here, called Mashmaker. And I'll throw the website up there, too. Thank you again, Michael. Appreciate you being here.
Thanks, Brad. Thanks, everybody.
Well, a big thank you to Michael Dawson for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Their educational program lets you learn about every aspect of brewing in detail. Take advantage of their fantastic sale and get 20% off any of their courses when you use the offer code BEERSMITH2018 at learn.beerandbrewing.com. And also Blickman Engineering, creators of the innovative new BrewVision wireless thermometer. Remotely monitor your brewing system from your iPhone or iPad, record data, set alerts, and grab recipes directly from the BeerSmith cloud. The BrewVision thermometer, another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, BeerSmith Mobile. The mobile version of BeerSmith is a perfect complement to our desktop brewing software. Check out BeerSmith Mobile at beersmith.com/mobile or on the Google Play, iTunes, or Amazon app stores. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.